Welcome to Back from the Abyss. I'm Dr. Craig Heacock. I wanted to give listeners a heads up about an interesting study being conducted at 20 centers around the United States, including here in Fort Collins. This is a trial using LSD to treat generalized anxiety disorder. Now, LSD for anxiety, it seems pretty counterintuitive, I know. But there are some interesting prior studies with LSD which suggest that it could in fact be helpful for clinically significant anxiety. You can find more information about the study at anxietyresearchstudy.com. I had a listener inquire about the trauma in the transference episode with Alexandria, and she wanted to know more details about how Alexandria and I healed the deep hurt in our relationship. Well, based on the work of Scott Miller, I sometimes use his concept of session rating scales after difficult sessions. And after Alexandria's second near-fatal suicide attempt, I made sure to save the last few minutes of every appointment for us to do a session rating. I would ask her to rate the session by giving it a letter grade and then justifying the grade. And then I would ask her to give herself a letter grade and justify it, and then give me a letter grade and explain it. And then I would ask what she and I could do differently or better if we could rewind the session and do it all over again. And finally, I would ask her, what didn't she bring up that day that she probably should have? I made it both a habit and expectation that every session would end with an honest and often difficult, both self-assessment and also an evaluation of me. I think this relentless assessment, this shared responsibility for making each session better, it helped us to eventually clear the hurt and move back into compassion and connection. Okay, this is the final story of season 4. Chris and I will be back with Fishbowl number 4 in 2 weeks. For today's story, I sit down with Wayne, a longtime patient of mine, a really wonderful human being, and a man who has suffered terribly with treatment-resistant depression and often crippling anxiety. And I think his story highlights a few crucial things. The fact that sometimes you can do everything right, do all the self-care things, and yet still be waylaid by the crushing dark force of depression. I think this story also illustrates the power of the therapeutic relationship and the fact that two people can deeply respect and care for each other, even when they land on opposite ends of the religious and political divide. I think you're going to like this one, and I can say, for me, it was super meaningful to record this.
I had two parents, brother and sister. I grew up in mostly in New Mexico. We moved around quite a bit. And by the time I was 10 years old in fourth grade, we moved 5 times. So I was usually the new guy. And in the middle of fourth grade, we moved to a small community in northern New Mexico, and I had always been the new kid, and once again I was the new kid. And something started happening where I would start crying just in the mid-mornings at school, and I really didn't know why. I wasn't trying to manipulate or anything like that. It just came on suddenly, and so my mom or my dad would have to come pick me up at school and take me home and reassure me. So one day, my mom picked me up very calmly, and she took me home and started spanking me. And then that worked into more beating. And I remember screaming, and she told me that...
Was she punishing you for crying at school?
I think she was punishing me, but she tells me later, she's told me later that the reason she did that was because she had counsel from some other counselor that said the way to treat depression in kids is through trauma, to try to shock them out of it, just spank them. And, she regrets it now, but she deflected blame to that other person. And I don't think there's any real excuse to do something like that, and so she told me that if I didn't stop, that they may have to send me away. And so that it did sort of shock me out of that crying every day at school. And I just started to force things down. And I didn't really I don't know if I struggled with depression a whole lot from then on. I probably did. I just didn't recognize the word depression. And so my childhood years, we still moved around quite a bit. And so by high school, I was kind of burnt out of moving and being the new kid, and wasn't very popular, but I liked sports, and I was very shy, and I had bad acne and bad asthma. I like to keep a journal. And when I was a kid, I loved to keep a journal. But my mom was so invasive into my privacy that I found out that she found my journal somehow, even though I'd hid it in my room. And so at that point, I just decided to go burn it in the fireplace. So now I don't have any records from my childhood from back then.
Was it like in middle school or high school?
This was in high school. Mm-hmm. Yep. And I remember her, she had a bad anger problem. Mm-hmm. She would shout curses at me and my siblings and me. And she would shout those curses. She would beat on us. I remember seeing her pulling my sister's hair and slamming her head into the floor. And she would tell us many times that someday we would find her in a pool of blood. Mm. And then we would appreciate her. Wow. And
clearly you were a sensitive kid. I mean, just imagining you. Mm-hmm. Going from school to school, and then you show up at this school in northern New Mexico, and you're crying and crying, and mom's answer is to kind of beat it out of you. Mm-hmm. And yet here, you're wired to be very sensitive to the world and other people, and mm-hmm. your mom's unloading, mm-hmm. unleashing all this mm-hmm. Fear and shame, and mm-hmm. almost like taking you guys emotional hostage. Mm-hmm.
Yes. She would also sometimes spit on us and just... put the old guilt trips on us for not appreciating her. Mm. But the way I see her is as a sort of a coin. On one side is this wonderful, loving woman who cared a lot for us. And on the other side, I just see this dark sort of a personality, someone that's just mean. Mm-hmm. And... I really regret that. So yeah, being raised, or my sensitivity now, I think some of it did come from her. She could be very kind. So it's a weird thing to grow up with someone that has such a contrasting personality.
Yeah, because what we all most need from our moms is consistency mm-hmm. and kindness and compassion. Sounds like you had that. Sometimes, and then mm-hmm. just flip. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you've said to me before that you wonder if maybe your mom had some kind of borderline personality disorder.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah. I read the symptoms for that, and it's check, 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 check.
Yeah.
My sister says she's a narcissist, but I don't see all the check marks for that, but I do borderline personality disorder.
Mm-hmm. When did the depression, sounds like the roots of it, were deep, but when did it really take hold when you look back? Was this more high school, college, or later? When did things coalesce into your first severe depressive episode?
I'd say right after college. I don't remember a specific episode. It just started really coming on in the form of angst and just, what is my purpose in this world? What am I working toward? And it just sort of slowly came on. And so the thing is, I would always sort of deny it, like, oh, depression is for weak people. Medications are for weak people.
Were those messages you were getting from your family or?
Just, I think, from society. Mm-hmm. I mean, my family, I have a family history of depression, especially on my mom's side. But I just got those perceptions. I think I've always been competitive. I've always wanted to be perfect. And so, I knew a couple of people that were always down, and I didn't want to be like that. And, And so I kept pushing that aside. So
it sounds like in some of those key developmental times of early adulthood, say going to college or picking a career, finding a wife, the illness of depression didn't limit that for you. You were able to get on a successful career track and find a wonderful spouse and start a family and complete college. And it was only later that things started to get really bad.
Right.
Yeah. I think that's one of the really difficult things about the illness of depression is, much like migraines, sometimes there are clear triggers or precipitants. Other times there are not. Other times people have a combination of genetic loading, early childhood trauma, personality factors, maybe being like a very sensitive soul that come together to produce that first really serious disabling episode.
I had a wonderful environment in my 30s and 40s. I worked for an Indian tribe for a while, and then I went to work for the federal government in their scientific branch. I had really fun hobbies, running, raising animals, and good friends, good doctors, I felt, great church. I was in pretty good health. Yet I always worried and struggled with wanting to do everything perfectly. And I knew this was in contradiction to the love of God. He loves me no matter what, but I still had that perfectionism. And so things just kept building up to a point when in my late 40s, I just felt like I couldn't put in an honest 40-hour work week anymore. And it took a couple of years for it to just really crystallize until I just told my boss, you know, I don't think I can do this anymore. And she was very kind. She let me take all my sick leave and she gave me paid or unpaid time off. And she tried to keep me in the government with my job there, but she's very gracious. But I just couldn't see myself having a future. And
so that's when you knew that depression had gotten really severe, again, something that had been in and out of your life for a long time. But here you were, late 40s, and right, you built a really solid career and were well thought of, and again, had lovely daughters and wife and competitive runner and hunter and churchgoer and like this very full life. And yet things just started crumbling such that you couldn't do your job.
Exactly. And so my employer didn't want me to leave, but I took a semi-retirement, and I immediately went into an outpatient facility, Myers Clinic in Dallas, for about a month, and they taught me some strategies for getting along with depression and anxiety. And of course, during this time, I had a lot of shame because, oh, now I'm not supporting my family. I'm not the primary breadwinner anymore. And
was this about the time that you and I met?
Yes, it was.
It was after you got out of this month-long treatment program.
Yeah, it was eight years ago. Mm-hmm. What triggered that final breakdown were several losses. One of my best friends at work died suddenly. I love to run long distance, and I injured myself, long-term injuries, so I lost those running friends. And of course, I lost my friends from work as I phased out. And we switched over from one church to another, so I lost some friends there. My daughters moved away to college.
So this was a time of huge losses.
Huge losses. Mm-hmm. That kind of put the seal on it for me leaving the job. Yeah, after that month, 6 weeks long treatment, I began to see you, and I saw started seeing a counselor here, and both of you are just indescribably wonderful, getting me on track. And you were able to prescribe some, figure out a good cocktail of medications to help me out. And
which in my memory did not work for very long.
No.
Because I'm not sure the timing, I don't know that it matters, but my memory is that pretty early in our treatment course, and again, this was pre-ketamine, that we decided that you needed to do ECT. Mm-hmm. And I had you go to Boulder, and I think you ended up doing like 35?
Exactly, 35.
ECT treatments, yeah. Mm-hmm.
The average number is like 8 or something like that.
Would you say that that was your most severe episode, your most difficult time? And again, this may be a difficult question to answer because ECT tends to wipe out memories around the time of the treatments. Or do you think that you were as bad or worse when you had the breakdown and went to treatment in Texas?
Yeah, I was as bad. Hmm. It was, my wife tells me, even though I can't remember much from that summer before ECT, she tells me that I would walk around the house just, you know, slamming my hands together and just saying, what am I doing? What am I doing? And she would try to help me. And I just was almost at the end of my rope because all these medications I had tried, they worked a little bit. They kept my head above water. You did. But we decided to reluctantly try ECT.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now, you know, a number of years out from that, what do you see as, what were the positives that came out of doing those 35 ECT treatments and maybe the downsides?
Yeah, the positives were, I used to ruminate a lot. I haven't mentioned that, but I ruminated before my breakdown, just thinking, am I doing this right? Am I doing this enough? And that rumination was really broken by the ECT. I don't ruminate as much. I still have a lot of anxiety, but I don't sit here and think through things.
And that's been a permanent effect.
I think so, yeah. And the other permanent effect is I don't have these angry fits anymore where I'm shouting at myself. I'm a lot more calm. Mm-hmm. So the drawbacks were, of course, the loss of memory. There are times in my life where there's a huge gap in several months, and then I'll look at photos of events during those months, and then I'll be like, yes, okay, I remember that now. So the memory's in there somewhere. There's just some kind of trigger that I need to remember it. But it really bugs me. Sometimes I can't think of the right words it's mostly long-term type memory.
Was there any part of you then or now that was maybe upset with me that I had recommended something that caused some long-term changes in your brain?
No, because that was one of the side effects that I was warned about, was memory loss, and I didn't care. I was suffering. Mm-hmm. And
I think our options were extremely limited. You know, I looked back and read some of my notes from that time before we recorded this, and you know, I felt pretty much at the end of my treatment rope. You know, that we tried so many things, and I think too, what's been you know, so gratifying about working with you, but also kind of difficult for me on the psychiatrist end, is you do everything right. You don't use substances. You have love in your life. You're devoted to your family. You run. You try to eat a good diet. You try to sleep on a good schedule. You have a church community. Like, you do all the things right. And so often when people aren't getting better, I think I or other docs could say, well, if they did X, Y, and Z that I want them to do, they'd get better. But you actually do everything I could ever want. And yet still, despite yours and my best efforts, you know, on those days before, during, after the ECT, it was brutal. I mean, I felt like we were kind of out of options.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was just kind of went from week to week. I remember starting the acute treatment with 2 or 3 times a week for a month or something like that. And you and the doctor in Boulder kept in contact, and I really appreciated that. And But you were there to support me during that time and to try to think ahead what would work as far as maybe some medications after the ECT. And then I had a relapse like 6 months later. Here we go again. Mm-hmm. Went through some more treatments and that worked for a while. And then you tried some other medications and that evened me out for about a year and a half.
But ECT just quit working for you.
Yeah. It just quit. It actually had the reverse effect.
Mm-hmm. I mean, fortunately, this timing wise, this was right around the time that I started working with ketamine. And I think you were one of my very first guinea pigs. I said, Wayne, I have this cool new treatment. All you have to do is just lay back on the couch.
Excellent.
And I'll just give you this little bitty shot in your arm and everything will be lovely.
Yes, that was 5 years ago in March.
Yeah, right. It's been 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe we could talk a little bit about your journey with ketamine because sure. You've been doing ketamine maintenance as long as anyone. You and I started together, and I think mm-hmm. you know 5 years now of doing maintenance treatments to keep you out of the depressive hole.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, tell me about your journey with ketamine.
So I like to tell the story to people about my very first trip. So you had told me, hey, have some music, some inspirational type music to listen to. And so I had that on my phone and plugged in the earphones. You gave me the shot. And so I start blasting off into space. And then on comes my Superman music and my Rocky music. And then when Wonder Woman music came on, man, that was like, it exploded my brain. I just like, yanked the earplugs out and continued. I've learned that you want calm instrumental music, not action movie music.
Yeah.
And so when I woke up from the treatment, I remember when I could finally, my vision came into focus, you said, hey, look out the window there. And your window was right next to the Poudre River with this beautiful view. And I look out, here's this beautiful strutting wild turkey. And maybe it's funny to others, but for me, it was an answer that this is the right thing to do because I had prayed, God, show me if this is something that I should really do. And when I woke up and I saw that wild turkey, I was like, yes, this is a sign from God. Because I love wild turkeys. I love nature. Mm-hmm. And it was just beautiful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That was my favorite part of my old office, how the wild turkeys would come and look in the window and just stand there and hang out. You know.
Yeah. So I remember going home, and I'd take a nap, but after that, I would feel immediate relief from that load of overwhelmment, anxiety, depression. And it was amazing because, I mean, even now, even today, the day after I have a treatment, I'm just like scrambling everywhere, getting things done, checking things off of my to-do list, and just feeling good about it. And for several days, it's like, this is what it feels like to be normal. Ah. Mm-hmm. And so over the years, it's lasted. At first, it lasted like the whole month, but it's kind of drawn back mm-hmm. a bit.
Yeah, I've learned so much about ketamine maintenance for severe chronic depression from you. One, because we literally started together, I think, and we've been doing it basically monthly ever since. And one thing we've learned, and this is actually applied to other patients, and it's something that I talk about when I speak about ketamine, is that ketamine does not replace meds if you have a really chronic treatment-resistant depression. And you and I, a number of times, you've been doing well, the ketamine's working so well, and I say, oh, let's peel back this med. In fact, a few months ago, I had you mm-hmm. peel back two meds. and you just plunged into the dark hole right after a powerful IV treatment. And so I want to thank you. I've learned a lot from you. You're kind of like patient zero. Your depression has been some of the hardest to treat of anybody I've worked with, yet it has responded well to certain things. But a lot of what I've learned about ketamine, I've learned from you and a small group of other people who were there from the beginning and have been doing this as a maintenance treatment. So again, thank you for being my guinea pig.
Well, you're welcome. No problem.
You're like, shouldn't I get some deal on the half price or some burger coupon afterwards? Yeah.
Some frequent flyer discount.
I know. Your treatments are not always scary, but they're often scary. Mm-hmm. And that's, that is a feature of higher dose, psychedelic K-hole ketamine is that, and maybe you could describe, I know ketamine is fairly indescribable, but when it gets scary for you, what do you experience?
Well, the first part is just fine. I'm sliding through a kaleidoscope factory or some sort of Christmas ornament assembly line or something like that. But I'd say toward the last 10 minutes when I've really in a state of sort of derealization, I know I'm there, but things are just completely out of my control. Those last 10 minutes, I'm imagining that the people around me are having a hard time waking me up, that I'm might be suffocating, that my heart's stopping, and that they've called in the EMS and they're all scrambling around me trying to get me to wake up. And that's been happening more often than I like. And so on our last treatment, on our most recent treatment, you gave me a little bit less medication and I didn't have that experience.
Yeah. I think what's been happening is as you've become a little more resistant to the ketamine treatments, I've pushed the dose up a little bit. And I think what we found, I have this with a couple other people too, where we're right at a dose range that, because I think the ego annihilation and it's pretty consistently can get scary. Mm. And again, I think in terms of, learning from your long-term folks, I think what I've learned is, it's so unhelpful when it's scary. I think it's better to try to change meds around, but to go a little lower, because you're right, the last couple times we've gone a little lower, and I think that was more manageable. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I wonder if we might shift gears and one just to talk about, and I know this is a topic you and I have explored before, and I think it might be really interesting to listeners. How do you think about why you have the illness of depression? Because I just pointed out a few minutes ago, you are, in many ways, you're one of the healthiest people I know. You and I are about the same age. You're a runner. Like, again, you don't use substances. You literally check every box for a healthy life. And you have incredibly severe treatment-resistant depression. How do you explain that to yourself? How do you understand that? How do you work through that?
Mm-hmm. Well, first term that comes to mind is genetics. I can look at my family history. I have a lot of cousins, so I have a large sample size I can look at that and see that there's more than the average number that suffer from depression and anxiety. I've had a few relatives who've had ECT, and several of them are still on medications.
I mean, that makes a lot of sense that, as you said, it's not just that you have a number of family members with depression. You have a number of family members who've had ECT, which by definition, at least in the last 20 years, that suggests these are folks with really severe, hard-to-treat depression. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and looking at my childhood, I guess, too, the losses and the abuse contributed to that. I think maybe if my depression was addressed earlier on, things would have been better. Mm-hmm. I don't know.
Yeah, if you do a thought experiment and imagine, and maybe this is unimaginable, but if you imagine having had really a loving, stable, consistent childhood sort of crucible with your mom and dad, do you have a sense how much you might be still suffering with the same kinds of depressive illness and perfectionism and anxiety that you do now? I mean, are you able to sort of tease out what portion of that is trauma, or is that too difficult to tease out?
Yeah, nature or nurture. Mm-hmm. I think that I'd still have problems. I think that it, besides for genetics, it's brain chemistry. There's just things that are not functioning properly there. And best we can do is things like getting good sleep and exercising and eating right and connecting with other people. Mm-hmm. And those are the four things that I try to do a lot. But even those don't always help. And so there's just something in the chemistry there.
Mm-hmm. I wonder too, and I think this kind of plays in with how you think about the illness of depression, is if we might explore this whole topic of faith, your Christianity, you're a devout Christian, and you made that very clear when we first met. And, you know, I fully recognize that people that have not only just faith and relationship with their God or creator, but who are in a faith community, that's often a really powerful mm-hmm. source of support. And I'm often encouraging people who did have some kind of faith community but have moved away from it, if they're open to that, maybe trying to get back mm-hmm. with that, because we're so disconnected, you know, in 2023. Yeah. How has your faith played in with your battle with this illness of depression, and how has it maybe helped, maybe not helped?
Right. Well, if I could just read a scripture passage, I know this isn't church or anything, but this really describes sort of my situation, I've always thought. So it's 2 Corinthians 12. St. Paul is speaking. He's saying, "A thorn in the flesh was given to me, a messenger of Satan to trouble me, so that I would not become arrogant. I asked the Lord three times about this, that it would depart from me. But he said to me, 'My grace is enough for you. My power is made perfect in weakness.' So then I will boast most gladly about my weaknesses, so that the power of Christ may reside in me. Therefore I am content with weaknesses, with insults, with troubles, with persecutions and difficulties for the sake of Christ. For whenever I am weak, then I am strong." And so I've seen this depression, anxiety, sometimes as a thorn in the flesh that God has sometimes allows to keep me humble. In other words, not to press me down, but to keep me more dependent on Him for peace and happiness. And so, but I also recognize that God doesn't make mistakes, that if it was in a perfect world, He would let me be happy.
One thing I've asked you about over the years is this idea of could your faith community ever be shaming you for having the illness of depression? You know, there's been a few episodes on the podcast of people who grew up in really strict legalistic religious communities where they felt extremely shamed for, you know, fill in the blank, for their abuse, for their addiction, for their depression. But each time I've checked in with you about that, it sounds like that's not been the case.
No, I just feel like that Jesus is, He loves me and He wants the best for me, and I'm not condemned by Him. I don't feel guilty toward God. Sometimes I do, but it's once in a while someone will will say to me, "Hey, you got to have faith, because without faith it's impossible to please God." And my response is that, well, you need to look at the whole that verse in context with the whole Bible and see that God is on our side, and that God doesn't call the qualified, He qualifies the called. Mm-hmm. And so He's on my side all the time. He gives me people like you. He gives me medications. He gives me my friends, He gives me my hobbies. He gives me the capacity to enjoy all those things.
Mm-hmm. I wonder, sometimes I think about this idea that, in kind of identity politics, like we need to have black psychiatrists for black patients, and we need to have gay therapists for gay clients, and we need to have, Mormon dermatologists for Mormon patients,
but Christian cows.
But I often think of the fact that I think humans can work with humans, be with humans. I often think of you and me, because while we have a lot of similarities, we both grew up in the same town. We're almost the same age. We ran cross country. We both have daughters who are about the same age. Like, we love to run. I mean, it's kind of shocking how much we share in common. Yes. But what we don't share in common, and I don't know if you asked straight up, or you just knew, like, I'm not religious. I'm kind of a panpsychic animist.
I've listened to your podcast.
Yeah, you know. But how is that for you? Because I've definitely had people I work with say, you're okay, but you're not really what I want, because you're not fill in the blank. Like, you're not a woman, or you're not a Christian, or you're not a, you're not this sort of identity group that I feel like that you need to be to be able to really understand me. Mm. But has there been any, how's it been for you? Because again, you said you have had a Christian counselor in the past. Your faith is so central in your life, and you have someone, me, who spends a lot of time with you, trying to help with you, who's not, not in that, not a believer.
Mm-hmm.
Has that been a struggle at all?
Not even from the beginning. When I spoke with you and asked you some questions about those kinds of things, you were honest with me. I could see that we were going to get along, because we were honest, but we were also respectful of each other. And I could see your compassion, and that you were a professional, that you weren't really into the identity politics. And I mean, if you were, I would be a little bit concerned, but I would also see through that at your own value to helping me. I mean, it's kind of a selfish thing on my part. And I mean, you're kind of like a brother to me. We've known each other for many years.
I know
you
say that a lot. That's so sweet. Whenever you say that, like, I do feel like a brother to you. Yeah. And especially that we have so many similarities and just,
Well, you're faster than me.
I'm your faster, younger brother.
That's right. Much faster.
I'm a little grayer than you too. I don't know what that means.
I color my hair. So.
Okay. Oh, all right. See, now the secret comes out.
Yes. But no, I haven't really classified you and made that a limitation. We just get along, and I wish the rest of the world could get along like this as well.
Mm. It is such one of the, and I've said this to you, I think I've said on the podcast, it is such one of the gifts of my work that I get to know and care about people who believe all sorts of different things. And because in my own life, my people are a lot like me, but in my, in my practice, I have, Trumpers and lefties and social justice warriors and hippies and meth bikers and born again Christians. I have all these people, and almost all of them are actually really nice. I'm just always struck by,
isn't that interesting?
Yeah, that almost everyone I see are just really good people. Mm-hmm. I mean, even if we believe very different things or come from different backgrounds.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's more reality than what we see in the media.
Mm-hmm. Wanted to talk about something that you and I, went through a few months ago, and it was so meaningful to me what you did, and I thought I want to talk about it on the recording today, which is earlier this season there was an episode called "Abortion in Three Acts," and I'll just put in a plug for this It's an amazing episode. I think the title put some people off, but maybe the people who didn't listen, this will trigger you to listen. It's a story of three women and their three abortions. The third storyteller is my wife, Elizabeth, and she tells the story of a 19 or 20 week late term abortion that we had. And so in any way, when I was getting ready to release this story, there were two people in my practice, you and one other person, who I thought both of you love the podcast, and I thought that could be really disturbing. So I called you and I said, hey, just a heads up, this episode's coming out. It's my wife and my describing our late term abortion and all the difficulty around that. And just want to let you know, because I know you're pro-life, that you you might find it really disturbing, right, that we are kind of like brothers and we're very close. And you were so sweet. You said, thank you. And, you know, I'll probably listen to it, but yeah, I'll go into it with this in mind. And then you sent me the sweetest letter. And I think you actually brought some excerpts from that letter.
Mm-hmm.
Did you?
Yes, I did.
Yeah. But maybe before you read that, you could say a little bit about what that was like for you. Again, because it's this whole other, the podcast is this whole other thing that I do. And then, you know, I'm calling you, I don't know, in the evening or a weekend and saying, hey, Wayne, heads up, like something's going to be coming out that you might find really disturbing, but I just want you to know. And I hope you don't, I don't know if I said, don't hate me. I don't know. but your opinion really mattered, because I knew you'd probably listen. And I thought actually, as we recorded it, I thought of you. I thought, I want this story to be something that Wayne could listen to and kind of be okay with it, if that makes sense, as much as that would be possible.
Yeah, that's amazing that you say that, because I didn't know that you were thinking about me before you recorded it. And I think the fact that you called me and asked me for a little bit of feedback was key in just my listening to this podcast with more of a detached mind rather than, okay, here's another poor abortion thing. They're going to make everybody feel guilty who doesn't agree with it, blah, blah, blah. But you wanted to engage in some conversation. And so I was happy to write you write back a little note. And do you want me to read from that?
Yeah, this if you point? Would, please.
So I said, my very first impression as I listened to the podcast was sadness for each individual that you interviewed and for the millions of other women who've had abortions. It's agonizing to know that so many people have to suffer in isolation. It breaks my heart to think about how many women suffer in shame when they consider abortion or go through it. I feel like God wants to wrap his arms around every individual who experiences shame, guilt, and loneliness. It took courage from you and the three women to reveal the pain. I will always be pro-life when it comes to abortion and pro-mother at the same time, regardless of what the mother decides to do. If someone speaks against abortion, he or she should also speak for the mother and find hope and support for her. The whole episode made me more conscious of labeling women who've terminated their pregnancies as murderers. It just doesn't feel right deep in my spirit to call someone that. Neither is calling pro-lifers terrorists. This kind of extreme language is hurtful. So in my view, the episode was necessary in facilitating understanding of such a personal issue. One of the guests made another great point. She said, women need more information on the whole process. That's definitely something that all parties can agree on.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah, it's meant so much that you took the time to write that. And there was much more in that letter, but it just, you just approached it really just mindfully and with a lot of trust. And I even think it's really helpful to be on my end of this, because, you know, I am pro-abortion rights, and, you know, I think it can get easy, you know, to be on one team and like, oh, the other team, like to demonize them, like, oh, that pro-life people or da da da. But again, like, as I said, one of the gifts of this practice is I have a number of anti-abortion, pro-life people in my practice. And I love them. Love you. Like, great people, amazing people with really good hearts who are coming at this issue with, I think, with love, you know, and from a very different perspective. And so that's another thing about, I wanted to bring up this episode again. I think one of the purposes of that episode was just to get people listening and thinking about something that's really hard to think about.
Mm-hmm. I'm definitely telling my friends about it.
Yeah, I appreciate that. As we're wrapping up, what if we might talk about one more dynamic that you and I have giggled about before, but it is a real thing. And that is, sometimes in a clinical practice, when two people have a lot in common and have a long relationship together like we do, you can run the risk of not wanting to disappoint. You know, and I've often thought, I've worried, and you and I have talked about it, that there's times that you have minimized your pain, minimized your struggle, maximized your gratitude and your kindness, because you do feel a lot of gratitude towards me. But the bigger thing, you don't want to disappoint me, because I think you know you and I are both trying really hard. And but I've worried, what's that been like on your end? And does that ring true that there's times where maybe you're not wanting to really lay out the full depth of how hard things have been?
Yeah. So appreciated my friendship and our relationship with you over the years, because you really care. We have a lot in common. We actually have fun conversations sometimes. But sometimes I do try to please you by saying what I think that you want to hear. It's just me. I don't want you to think that you're a failure. I want you to know that you're the best I could ever ask for. And you actually take time to listen to me and actually give me strategies rather than just asking me a couple of questions and handing out meds. Mm-hmm. And you're also tolerant and encouraging of my love for things like hunting and God. And I appreciate that. And you've always shown concern. And even after my ketamine trips, you'll come in and start asking me these deep questions. And I'm like, wait a second, I'm half drunk here. But I appreciate that too. You once in a while you text me, how are you doing? And you're open to me calling you or texting you whenever. I don't bug you. I don't take advantage of that. But just to know that you're there is huge. I don't want to disappoint you. And I know that you would say, well, don't worry about that. But I still have that sometimes, especially since I've been your patient for so many years.
Yeah.
I'm wondering if you think, well, that dude should be well by now.
Yeah. Well, I wonder too, if this also goes deeper, if this is a transference thing. I wonder if there's part of, if this is also like a parent, kind of a parent-child thing, that there's part of you, there's a deep, deep, deep part of you that wants to be fully accepted and seen and heard and validated, because you didn't get that as a kid. And I don't know that we've talked about that specifically, but that's one of the things. I think that's another layer of this, that there's part of you that so wants my approval, not just as me, Craig Heacock, but also as kind of a powerful, like almost parental figure, which is funny that, you know, I'm a couple years younger than you, but that's the way transference can play out.
Yeah, I can see that. I would admit that. I haven't thought about that particularly in that way, but it's kind of how it works. Mm-hmm. And I do that sometimes with other people in authority. I do that with my counselor, and so that's something I should keep in mind.
Yeah, I'll try to remind you.
Yeah, please, because over the years, you've had to remind me of things many times, and sometimes I feel like, oh, he thinks I'm I'm stupid because I'm just not listening to him. No. He has to tell me the same thing 18 times.
No, because that's because psychotherapy is cyclotherapy. Cyclo. It comes around, right? All our issues are our issues. We need to be gently and often repetitively reminded. As we're wrapping up, is there anything else that you want to add or say, or any things that we skipped over?
I don't like to label myself as being depressed or being anxious. I like to say that I struggle with anxiety and I struggle with depression because my identity is not in my mood or my sexuality or my color. My identity is in Christ and my union with Him. And someday things will all be great.
I do think that good things are coming both for Wayne and for psychiatry as a field. This is surely the most hopeful and exciting time in mental health in my lifetime. Tune in for Fishbowl in 2 weeks. Chris and I will do our annual Back from the Abyss review. And also, I'll be at Psychedelic Science in Denver next month. So, if you see me, come up and say hi. I'd love to chat. Chris and I are planning to do another summer special episode in July, and then we'll start season 5 this fall.